The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Hello there, and a very good morning to you. You're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning, and we will start off with the lead story in the Irish Daily Mirror. Son charged with parents' murder. Man 42 denies killing the OAP couple at their home, but whichever way that develops, it is just an inordinate human tragedy. The Irish Daily Star, I'll blow up the auras. President Michael D. Higgins had to flee his bed in his nightclothes during an auras bomb scare. Drama took place after a teen made a phone call threat on Tuesday. Now, I'm sure that was highly inconvenient, to say the least. I don't know. Very hard to see anybody wanting to kill our president. Not a controversial figure or anything like that. But I have to say, I shouldn't be flippant, and I'm not being flippant. But I can anticipate comedy scripts now that will go from here to kingdom come about the president in his pidgeys and his dressing gown and all of the rest. But anyway, all's well that ends well, and no harm suffered by anybody. Now, Weekend Herald. M7 carnage gang caught on camera, and this is allegedly the burglary gang whose high speed chase with the Gardaí led to the death of an innocent woman, and they say it was on a drunken crime spree, and she lost her life on that. The Irish Independent: plan to extend age limit for children's free water allowance. I have to say, nothing really changes, does it? To the best of my knowledge, the decision was made that one way or another, 1.2 billion, I think we're getting very flippant about our billions these days, is needed, is required, will be demanded, is expected, will be squeezed out of Irish citizens, one way or the other, for this water. And you can say, right, you pay twopence more and I pay threepence more and you pay fourpence less. But that's the number. And presumably, no matter what way it goes, that's the number they're going to get. But I suppose this is part of what we're sometimes told is spin and political consequences and things like that. Now, the Irish Daily Mail, gang rampaged to M7 crash death. That's that same story. The Irish Examiner, 420k car park for water buses. And you remember the aforementioned 1.2 billion? Well, 420k of it is going to go for car expenses. Though I suspect that if you're supplying water up and down the country, that you actually do have to travel, and that you probably do have to travel in a car. But anyway, the warning over Cahill response language. This is a warning, really, from the rape crisis centres arising from Maria Cahill's claims. And their last story there, patient on trolley had handbag stolen. How awful is that? Miserable enough on a trolley in a hospital. Anyway, the Irish Times. Finally, Draghi warns Euro leaders of, quote, relapse into recession. And on the front of the Financial Times and the front of all the English papers is the story about the fact that 1.7 billion has been popped out as the bill for the Brits to pay into Europe. And just in case you wonder what's happened to us, we have to pay too. There was a time when we didn't, when we only received. But we have had an increase in our contribution, and the increase is due to a number of factors, including upward revisions to Ireland's gross national income for previous years. In other words, we seem to be kind of doing well because they're bumping us up. Originally, we said by 150 and they said, no, you got that wrong. So you have to pay another 7 million. But as somebody pointed out to me, well, should we regard 7 million now like money you'd pull out of your back pocket? We've got so used to billions. But you have to have a certain sympathy for the Brits. I mean, Draghi warning there about the Euro leaders. The English and the British took the risk and they did their quantitative easing and they were ridiculed by many an economist, and it would appear it worked, and they put in the effort and they worked hard and their economy has improved. And who gets the benefit? The crowd in Europe that wouldn't budge. And I mean, the French come in for a lot of grief on this one because they have been like impossible, I gather, on trying to take the tiniest little bit of austerity and pulling in belts and all that. Anyway, the British are getting punished for being successful, I suppose, and consequently have to pay for those who didn't make the effort. Anyway, and they have another story on their charity paid executive members' husbands £2,350 for singing. That story goes on and on. Now, an extraordinary story has been unfolding in the UK regarding an abandoned mother and son and an undercover policeman. And, you know, shades of Le Carré, I know it said a lot, but really this is a story that does have shades of Le Carré. This week, the Metropolitan Police agreed to pay £425,000 sterling to the woman known as Jackie, who did not know that the man she loved and the man she lived with, she thought, full time for 3 years, and the father of her son was an undercover policeman, and he one day vanished into thin air and she never knew why. And I mean, her story came out, and I mean, there was denial, and there's a nice little term of, you know, don't commit or don't whatever, don't deny or don't commit, that is used to protect the police in these stories. But it's a real live story, Jackie, and it's your story. And I've been thinking about it ever since I read about it. And you take the view that you shared your life, as it were, with a ghost.
Yes, I did. Yes, good morning.
Good morning to you. You were an animal activist and he joined your group of animal activists as an animal activist. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was involved in animal rights activist group and I met him at a demonstration that we were having in London. And he came up, started talking to me, and it kind of developed from there. And we started a relationship, which to me was just, you know, the same as any other relationship, courtship,
romance,
and definitely romance. He seemed to, he seemed to be besotted with me. That's the way I thought it was.
When you told him you were pregnant, he appeared to be delighted.
Well, I was with him for over a year before I got pregnant. It wasn't I suddenly just accidentally got pregnant.
Right.
I mean, we were together. We'd set up home together. If you like, we even had a cat together. We, as far as I was concerned, you know, he was my partner, and we made a decision to have a child. I mean, I met him in early 84. I didn't give birth till the end of 85, so I didn't get pregnant straight away, or it was any accident or anything like that. This was just the natural progression of the relationship. I mean, I knew he was quite a bit older than me. He's 12. I think he's 12 years older. I mean, even now today, I don't know the exact details, but at the time, I thought he was 12 years older than me. I was 22, so he was 34. Most of us activists were sort of in our late teens, early 20s. He did look older than us. He sort of, I suppose, looking back in hindsight, he sort of turned up from nowhere and then was suddenly everywhere. All the meetings, I was a hunt saboteur. He was at the hunt saboteur meetings with me.
I gather he was absolutely wonderful when the baby was born.
Well, he was with me as you'd expect any partner. He was with me during the birth. as it, my first child. So I was in labour for 14 hours. He was by my side doing all the things you expect, you know, rubbing my back, holding my hand, mopping my brow, looking after me. And in fact, he held our son before I had a chance to hold our son, because I'd had an epidural, so I was kind of out of it a bit. And in fact, you know, he was holding our son and sort of showed him to me. And I mean, there's a photograph that's quite widely out there of him at the maternity hospital, holding our son, and looking at him like any other father would look at what I thought was his firstborn child.
Well, you thought that was his firstborn, and life continued on happily for another 2 years.
Yes, we did. So altogether, it was sort of 3.5 years we were together. Yep, he was hands-on dad. He did all, he quite impressed my parents in the way that he, he changed nappies. He took him out with him. I even, my child was about sort of 6 months old, went to Italy with some friends of mine for a break, and he looked after our son on his own for the whole week. That's how much I sort of kind of trusted him and how much of a sort of hands-on dad he was.
And did he go away? Did he go away for a few days every week?
Well, no, I now know, and I now, you know, I've heard that these, what they call deep swimmers, these undercover officers, they only actually get to see their family every few weeks for one day. I mean, that's why they're paid so much, because of that. Remember, we're talking about the days when there was no mobile phones, so you didn't track people in the same way you could now. If he told me he was away working or he was away on animal rights actions, because I had a young baby, you know, if there was a demonstration going on, perhaps there was a chance I couldn't take the baby with me. So if he was away, that's where he was. I had no reason to believe otherwise. I mean, I suppose, looking back, perhaps he did disappear, but not that you would be suspicious. And as my first love, and I was a young girl, I kind of had no reason to disbelieve him. I certainly didn't want to try and track him down and follow him every time he left the house.
And tell me, how did it end?
He once come to me, there's been an animal rights action of a kind of some incendiary devices going off in the Debenhams, which is a department store in the UK, because they were still selling fur coats. And he, as far as I was concerned, was involved in that. And there'd been some arrests. Some people had been arrested over it. And he, because one of the things which is the irony is that he was always, to me, paranoid about infiltrators in the movement. He even wrote an article in our newsletter about how to spot an infiltrator. And he came to me one day in 87 and said that he'd, people were getting arrested, which I knew they were. Things were getting really hot. It was just a matter of time before Special Branch were going to arrest him. And he needed to get out of the country. He said he knew some anarchists in Spain that would help look after him, and he could hide out there. He sort of said to us, he said he was going to, leave, but he would never abandon his son. So he said it was just a matter of time before he'd be in contact with me and I would be able to take our child over to Spain to see him. And that was it. He that night when he left and I saw the back of him, that was the last I saw of him until I heard from him and saw him 24 years later.
And he never did keep up contact with your son?
I got a letter a couple of months with the postmark from Spain, saying it was still quite, it still wasn't sort of safe for me to come over there because they were probably watching me as well. And then that was it. That was the last contact. Through the years, government agencies like the Child Support Agency, social services tried to find him. I got married. I met somebody else and married. Unfortunately, my husband died 5 years later at the age of 36, very suddenly. So then I was 31. I had two children by then. So my son had lost two dads by the time he was seven.
Oh, that's so tough, yeah.
Yeah, so by the time he sort of got into his early teens, even earlier than that really, from about age 10, 11, he started almost becoming sort of obsessed with finding his natural dad. And once the internet was up and running and things like Facebook and Friends reunited, he tried all he could to find his dad. And we even hired a private detective to try and find him. As I said, we had government agencies trying to find him. We've got it kind of in writing where they write back and say, I'm afraid they're unable to find Mr. Robert Robinson, which I knew him as Bob Robinson, that this man was on the run, that he was involved in the Animal Liberation Front, and that he was wanted by the police. So it was very unlikely that he was going to be found. I explained to his son that his dad did love him, but perhaps his dad had had to sort of start a new life somewhere, or he'd done a prison sentence and decided to come out and start a new life. I didn't know.
So you eventually found out that he was not whom you thought he was, and that he was still alive and well, that he had a wife all during that time. And we subsequently learned that there was a third relationship around that time as well.
That wasn't until the sort of very end of our relationship, and that was it's how it come out about the fact that he had a child is because that woman came forward and she remembers him having a toddler with him, having somebody he called his son and naming my son,
right?
And she didn't know. Well, was that his real child? Was that kind of some sort of prop that the police had? What was this child that he always had with him? They went to the park together and things like that.
Did it dawn on you that he was an undercover policeman?
Completely by accident, on June the 14th, 2012. Obviously, I'll never forget the date. I happened to come home from work, picked up the newspaper for that day and was flicking through it. It was June, it was warm, I was sitting in my garden. And I saw a picture of him from the 80s, and there he was. That's how I found out. Obviously, I went into absolute shock. I was like something from The Walking Dead. I was just pacing around, didn't know what to do, who to phone, what to say. I think the first people I phoned was my parents, who obviously had known him as a kind of son-in-law. They got out their photos of the birth and photos they had of him at family functions and things like that, confirmed, yes, it was him, but I'd known it was him anyway. I spent all that night sort of Googling it and seeing that it was everywhere, and the story had been out for about 6 months, but it had been in a newspaper called The Guardian, of which I don't read and none of my friends read, so I hadn't seen it. The next morning, the very next morning, as soon as it turned 9 o'clock, I'd read that his real name was Bob Lambert. I read that he worked now as an academic at St Andrews University. And so I rang St Andrews University the next day and asked to be put through to him. He wasn't there, but the woman that I spoke to, because I was obviously very upset and she could tell that, and I said I was the mother of his child, she said she'd get a message to him and would ring me back. And 10 minutes later, the phone rang, and it wasn't this woman. It was Bob. And he said, "Hi, Jackie, it's Bob." And that is the first I heard of him for 24 years. By now, our son was 26. We had a phone call. We exchanged email details. And I didn't know about instructing a lawyer or anything like that. I just... And so for quite a few months after that, my contact was with him and his now second wife, who he doesn't have any children with. I did ask, one of the first questions I asked was, does my son have any brothers and sisters, thinking they would be younger than my son. And he told me, yep, and it turns out that my son was his third child, and that when I gave birth, he had not only had a wife, but he had a 9-year-old and a 10-year-old son and daughter. So I found it out from there.
And when and how did you decide to pursue this with the Metropolitan Police?
Well, when I've been Googling, I noticed that some other women and have come forward, including the woman that had the few months relationship with Bob towards the end of our relationship, and I'd sort of read about that, and they had all been in contact with a solicitor, so I contacted that lawyer as well, and I was then she couldn't take my case, but she passed me on to Jules Carey from Bynemans, and I think that was the end of August, 28th of August 2012, and then once he became my lawyer, he didn't like the idea that me, Bob, and his second wife were communicating with each other. He thought I was being manipulated once again, and he put a stop to that correspondence. He wrote to him.
Yeah, I just want to give a quote about a statement from Scotland Yard saying the Metropolitan Police Service unreservedly apologises for any pain and suffering that the relationship an undercover officer has had with this woman. We recognise the impact that the revelation that he was an undercover police officer must have had on both her and her son. From the outset, we have dealt with this with professionalism and sensitivity, completely understanding the gravity of the circumstances we regret, and so on and so on and so on. We want to be as open as we possibly can, but we need to maintain the policy to neither confirm nor deny. Can I go to another guest with me here in studio this morning? It's John Murphy. He's a scriptwriter now. He was a detective with the London Metropolitan Police for 18 years.
Okay.
And you were in the police force at around the time we're talking about here. John, tell us a little bit about this undercover work and so on.
Yeah, I mean, first, I was a street level detective for a long, long time. I've experienced working through undercover guys. I've never heard anything like this. I've never in my life, in my entire association with the organisation, heard anything like it. And there's an awful, it's huge. There's an awful lot of unanswered questions here. And I have to wonder whether or not they'll ever be answered. The phrase that you
exactly.
read there from the Yard saying we want to be as open was immediately followed by the word but. I don't know. I just think that there was a culture when I joined. We were told, and I'm literally told, that it was a war on crime. And if you look at this whole scenario, this war, you know, spies. And Margaret Thatcher used a term called the enemy within. She wasn't talking about the IRA who tried to blow her up. She was talking about minors. It was very easy to convince us as young men that there was a war going on when we were just really a civilian workforce on the streets of a civilian
providing
population
a service,
in peacetime.
Yeah.
But it justifies, that kind of culture justifies the end to the means. People do things in a war that they don't do in peacetime, and it's easy. It becomes easier and easier to justify things as they go along. The other thing, though, I think that distinguishes this case is this officer and several of the others that have come to light for these stories worked in a special deployment squad, which became the National Public Order Intelligence Unit. That was special branch. Special branch in England means a totally different thing to it does here to us. You know, in Ireland, special branch means plainclothes CID officers.
Yeah.
In England, special branch means the political police. It means officers who specifically deal with political crimes and political concerns and security. They were different to us. They were, they tended to be better educated. It tended to be a lot of university. We used to call them posh cops. They didn't have much to do with us. But in 1968, outside the American embassy in Grosvenor Square, there were huge demonstrations in London, and it shocked the British society like nothing had ever done before. There was a lot of violence. policeman who'd never encountered a situation like that, who didn't have riot gear, didn't have riot training, and they barely defended the embassy. They almost lost the embassy that day, and it terrified them, and it gave birth to the notion that there was an enemy within, that there was subversive movements, especially following on the back of what had happened in America with, you know, the Black Civil Rights movements, and it gave birth to them creating a fear that there were organizations at work in their own society seeking to overthrow them. And it rallied the police, the government, and whole sections of the populace, MI5.
You were sent in, actually, I thought this one was rather amusing now, and I don't mean to trivialise the work or any part of the story in any way. They were going to do a raid on an Irish pub.
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, I wasn't an undercover policeman, but I was... the point I was just making is we just feed into the atmosphere of fear that existed at the time. In the early 1980s, every police station wanted to do something about the Irish terrorism problem. You know, they wanted to be seen to be doing it. But they didn't have a clue culturally about Ireland or, you know, the way things worked. And very much as we see in later years, a mosque, which is a place where one section of society gathers, is the immediate go-to visible target for there must be something wrong with that. And they called me in one night with another Irish guy, and they sent us up to... they said they were going to raid this place called the Emerald Club, which was an Irish drinking backroom place, which hadn't got its licensing paperwork in order entirely. Yeah. And they said it was full of subversives and that they wanted us to go in and take out the lookouts. We were in there, me and Leo, every second night of the week. They knew us very well. The lookout in question was an old guy who sat at a door called John, who gave you a raffle ticket when you went in so you could win a joint of meat. They were just full of ordinary working people. I remember just thinking, what do we do? You know, it wasn't a good idea to say we were in there because it wasn't a licensed drinking club. So I remember me and Leo running up the stairs and trying to explain to them, you know, the police are coming in, they're going to go around, they're going to ask lots of names, you know, just... And I remember them saying, oh yeah, bring them in, you know, they're welcome, come on. And I'm going, no, it's a raid. But that was the kind of... You know, imagine if you could convince ordinary working police officers that they needed to do this into that place, you know, without knowing and having an idea about what they were going into.
But you were saying that there were people within the... Like, there were walls within walls. We talk about Chinese walls in accountancy firms, but there were walls within, and there were undercover operatives, and presumably there were people in charge of those who would be very loyal to them.
Yeah, there would be. I mean, it's immensely... I mean, I'm still flabbergasted by Jackie's story, but I come from the criminal point of view, you know, and... Some of the guys that I saw who dealt with either armed gangs or drug dealers were immensely brave. It will take its toll on you.
I'm just trying to think of that man running the amount of lies. Like, it's very hard to keep a lie going without letting it slip. But anyway, sorry, yeah, I'll come back to that.
But I can't even these. I mean. And that, so because of what they do and the nature of what they do, they're highly thought of in their own circle. And they would be very protected by their immediate peoples. Like, if you go on an undercover operation, you have an uncle with you. He's not part of the operation, but he's there for your security. They would be immensely loyal, and they would guard. And I wonder what happened here. I mean, there's two things that could have happened here. Either they didn't know, right, which means they were pretty bad at running that department, you know, or they did know. And they didn't do anything, which means that Jackie became collateral damage in whatever war.
In whatever
they
war
think they
was
were waging
being waged
on whoever.
Yeah.
And then there's the people who don't want to know. I blame them most of all, I have to say.
And the people who don't,
people
want,
who don't
to
want to know. You know, these are people who are usually fairly high up, who have some idea what's going on, but are too afraid to ask, or even don't want to know and acquiesce to it. And I think throughout any problems the Metropolitan Police has had in my lifetime, they bear the responsibility more than any, you know.
Yeah, because you do have a certain sympathy for the poor person, as you would see it, that is undercover. But you're saying that, for example, if you were going after drugs and you were undercover, that you had to break the law.
Another fundamental problem. When I joined, back in the 70s, We were told the system didn't work. You know, that the actual system...
You were formally told that this...
Absolutely told this from the first day you hit the streets, from the, almost before you leave the training school. And the, our job then was to make the system work, you know? So and it, you so that manifested itself in all sorts of ways, you know? That they were, we were told that, that simply advising people that they didn't have to tell us anything and had the right to a solicitor wasn't a good idea because they'd shut up. Which is actually what their right is. It's the whole point. So we were discouraged from giving the caution, you know. But it was presented. Now, that's very small. And like it was, buskers are supposed to be warned before they move. They're never warned. They're just arrested. And then a couple of warnings were written in. That's tiny. But if you take that up the ladder, it can go. It can go anywhere, you know. It could, so and they're saying that an undercover drugs guy was told he couldn't take drugs. So. That is not practical. That does not work. There's no way in the world that that works. You know.
Explain to people why it doesn't.
Because he, if you're in that environment, you're in that environment because you have an affinity or an association with drugs. To be in that environment amongst people who have that and abstain is like wearing a T-shirt that says undercover police officer on it. And you cannot progress. You certainly cannot progress unless you can immerse yourself. Immerse yourself. That's what undercover is. It's immersing in that world. And so they take drugs. They just don't say they take drugs. So the guys immediately above them know they take drugs, but they never report that they take drugs. And then they hire up the higher echelons of Scotland Yard. They all know what happens. They just don't want to ask.
They questions. Don't want to know no, that they're
no,
taking
they
drugs.
Don't. Yeah. And, you know, somebody in an armed gang is supposed to be the driver on a bank robbery. Just the driver. Never ever to hold a gun, never ever to enter the bank. It's the same, isn't it? Right? Who wants to be a driver? You have to be able to drive for a start, you know? So if you're going undercover and you're not some kind of a first-class driver, how do you pass yourself off as the driver? So you go in the bank. You know, you just try not to wave the gun around too much.
Very weird. Does it still go on a lot, do you know?
It's changed. I imagine it's changed. I imagine it's changed because of cases... Well, I've never heard a case like this, but because of some of the consequences and being held to accountability, but technology has changed it, you know.
Because you don't...
You're not on your own as much as you ever were, you know. We're talking now where we can follow a car with a satellite and be two miles behind it, you know. Where before, you were just sometimes wearing a wire, but that was at your discretion because you didn't want to be found with the thing on you. And or you weren't. And, go back. Mobile phones are not that old, you know. A mobile phone is a bugging device. It can tell you where you were. But back then, you could claim to be anywhere and there was nothing to verify it.
Except your word.
Yeah. So, I, you know, the guys who are... And the law will tell you what to do afterwards. It's fantastic, isn't it? You know, you're out on the cover in that situation and if you get it wrong, the law will tell you got it wrong and then the case will suffer because of it. But you're out there trying to make that decision there and then. You have no references. You just... And your personal safety is at stake.
You had a small... Well, a part of a group for the monk painting, the Scream.
Yeah, I have a working knowledge of the theft of the Scream. And I suppose, look, I'm not here to defend undercover operatives. I'm pretty shaky about it myself. What I will say, though, is in the current age, when we're trying to deal with crime, there's very little that organised criminal gangs are afraid of anymore. They're not afraid of the law. They're not afraid of the police per se. They're afraid of this. They're afraid of traitors. They're afraid of not trusting the person next to them. It is still a powerful weapon. Interestingly, with Edward Monk had a painting called Scream, which is quite famous. And
Sure is famous, yeah.
Many years ago, it was stolen from the National Gallery in Norway on the opening day of the Winter Olympics in Lillehammer. And they set about getting it back. They went to Scotland Yard and they got a team of highly effective undercover policemen, including an American who happened to be a Scotland Yard officer. And they brought back the painting, recovered the painting. It was an incredibly well-run, successful sting. But they actually employed police officers from another country to come and do it for them. The interesting thing about that is four people were arrested. They were caught red-handed with the painting. But they were later released because Norway took the view that the police officers had entered the country with false identities and false passports. Therefore, that was an infringement of the law. And they threw the case out because in Norway wouldn't accept that you can break a law to protect the law. And it's very interesting to look at the situation we're dealing with here, going back through all right. those years.
Let me go back to Jackie for a moment. Jackie, there are endless things that people want to know. One of the things that John was talking about there was that an undercover person like that would have a contact that would be watching him and minding him. Have you any, I know we all talk about hindsight, did you have the remotest feeling that he was dealing with somebody else or somebody else was watching him?
Absolutely not. And as I said, he was one of those that kind of seemed to be paranoid about infiltrators. He wrote on one of our newsletters how to spot an infiltrator. I think it's interesting what I've just heard, you know, about the miners and the within. Well, I kind of, that is around the time that sort of the animal rights movement were, if you like, a bit of a pain in the bum to the establishment at the time. And I mean, no one ever got hurt through anything the animal rights movement did, but they were causing a lot of economic damage, and they were,
I remember. People will remember.
They were causing trouble to the establishment, and that was all around the same time. I mean, 84, 85, I mean, that's when I was with Bob. No, in no way did I have any idea whatsoever.
Now,
what I do know is that he did have a handler. They all had a handler. I told you that for a few months I was actually seeing him and in contact with him after 2012 when I found out. And he told me that on the animal liberation movement or the animal rights movement itself, there was 20 plus undercover cops just on that movement alone, not just in London, throughout the whole of the UK. And that's why I find it really hard to believe that his bosses didn't know about it, because even if his individual handler was deaf, dumb and blind and absolutely incompetent, then one of these others must have said, well, Jackie's obviously pregnant. You can see she's pregnant. And then after I was pregnant, he took our son with him to a lot of demonstrations. I mean, really, it was a perfect cover for him. Because
did you get a sense? I've about 942,000 questions that our listeners want to ask.
You can ask me as many as you like.
Well, I can't go that far. But do you believe that either it was his decision or that there was a policy that it would be a good idea to use sex, for want of a better word, and pretend romances to gain credibility?
Absolutely. I don't think it. I kind of almost know it, because the other women that are involved, not with Bob, but with other undercover cops, first of all, if this was looked down on, if he was a rogue officer like they like to sort of portray him as, then when he went back to Scotland Yard after his deployment, then why was it sort of said, well, he's not really suitable for this kind of work,
right,
and put on other work?
Okay.
Instead, he was promoted, and in fact taught his apprentices, because the other women who later on in the 90s and even up to the 2000s, so it's not long ago, even all the way up to sort of 2005 that we know about, and Bob was the boss of them, they used exactly the same tactics. The courtships were the same. The fact about using the van to pick up activists and drive them home, that's a good way to find out
right.
where they live.
Okay, well, I've got that.
Everything was the same.
Why am I never surprised that the collateral damage, as you were talking about...
Can I just tell you, it's quite important, the only difference between me and the other women is they didn't have a child. And the one that I've heard now, the reason that I've heard from a whistleblower who has, you know, gone public, he said that they were told about bedding in. It was 1900s, have you bedded in?
Nice phrase.
And also, they were told by Bob himself when he was the leader of this unit, so years later, that the one thing you did was to wear a condom. because he told a story of an officer who kind of got a woman, an activist, pregnant, and for him personally, it was a disaster. And he used this third person. Now, we now know that the person he was talking about was himself. Because he's the only one that had a child.
I want to... I'm sorry to cut across you, but I just want to ask you two questions. One, do you have any idea about how his wife knew or felt about all of it? Well, I can imagine how she felt, but how she knew about it or reacted to it. And the other people want to know, how does your son feel about his dad now? I gather it's a good relationship. And what did you tell your son about why he didn't keep up contact?
My son was away in the Far East travelling. He was 26 when this all first came out.
All right.
So I had a couple of weeks, and then when he came back, I sat him down and I said to him, "Your dad's turned up, but it's a bit complicated, to say the least."
And how did he take it? It certainly is complicated. How did he take it?
Really maturely. I think that because he'd lost. Because of my husband dying when
death,
he was young,
yeah.
He really wanted a dad. About a week or so later, they exchanged email details and then they started meeting each other. In fact, they met each other for the first time Wimbledon final day, which was about, I think, the 8th of July, 2012. So they've now had a relationship for over 2 years. It's flourishing. It's doing really well. And
right.
I wish him well for that. And I hope that continues.
Okay.
I've got no problem with that.
Okay. And sorry to move you on, but I just have to. Just finally, about his wife.
Okay, yeah.
Did she know? Have you spoken to her?
Well, I've spoken to his second wife. Spoken to her quite a lot because the meetings we had, she would come with him. She didn't know anything about it until the papers outed him. And then he went home one evening and told her that not only had he had relationships with women, but that he'd had this long-term relationship with me and fathered this child. As far as his first wife is concerned, I only know about her via his second wife because apparently they have quite a good relationship.
Right.
She doesn't want to be involved. She doesn't
want to make
a comment. I think journalists have traced her. They've managed to try to talk to her. She refuses to talk to them and
right.
wants to remain anonymous.
Okay. You want to come in, John?
It's an enormous story, and God help us with the blame game that's going to follow it. But we can make it quite simple, can't we? If I have a wife and two children, and if somebody asks me to do a job that involves sleeping with another woman and starting another family, how about just don't? How about just don't do it? You know?
Well, somebody suggested today it could be heaven on wheels for a bloke.
It could, isn't it? Isn't it just perfect? Isn't it? You know? But, you know, look at the consequences, and it all came down to one man's simple decision, and I'm afraid at the end of the day that's where I am with it.
Yeah, right. Okay, listen, we'll have to leave it there. Jackie, thank you very, very much indeed for taking our call, and we wish you well, and we wish your son well indeed too. And John Murphy, thank you so much indeed for coming in.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.